coming, slowly, here in New England, and we're excited about the whole idea of change and new beginnings and birds and grass and stuff like that. What does that have to do with hashtag amwriting? Well, maybe it's time for a new beginning for you as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator's book coaching program say they often begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and they end up being booked ahead months in advance. Sound like fun? I absolutely agree. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, a podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, fictional things, non-fictional things, semi-fictional things, whatever those might be, and it sounds dangerous. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels. My latest one is called Bombshells, and you can find me wherever ebooks are sold.
And I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the novel, The Chicken Sisters, the nonfiction book, How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor at the New York Times of the Motherlode blog, sometimes freelancer, mostly fiction writer, finding my way in the universe, all those things. And we have a guest today.
We do. I'm so excited about this one, primarily because I love her writing so much, and also having her on the podcast meant that we got an early look at her new book. So that was like just icing on the cake. Please welcome Vari McFarlane, who was born in Scotland. After some efforts at journalism, she started writing novels, and I love them all. I've read 3 of them so far, and I'm sort of saving one in reserve for if I have a really bad day. You know, have you ever done that? So her latest book is called Just Last Night, and we are going to try to talk about it without spoiling it, but it will not be easy, and we have some other writing questions for Vari, so welcome.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
We are so excited to talk to you about your books because we love your voice, and I don't just mean your really cute Scottish accent. But you write such a voicey fiction that it's the kind of narrative that honestly I struggle to go back to my own books after I'm reading one of yours because it's just there's so much life on them. And sometimes authors get these comments like, I could read your shopping list or whatever. And that's kind of how I think of you because it would be really entertaining, I have to say.
Thank you.
My first real question for you has to do with genre and where you see yourself in the genre spectrum, because I feel that your books are really like a true crossover between something that should be shelved in romance and women's fiction. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about that question and how you came to be right where you are in terms of genre.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure how British genre maps onto American, because I don't know if you have. I know there are other countries where I'm published where romance has a very specific definition. And I think it's far more loosey-goosey, to use a British phrase over here. So the short answer and the honest answer is I don't really know. But when I set out, I was very, very happy to be pigeonholed in chick lit, in heavily inverted commas. The only thing was that I very much wanted to look like myself. So I remember with my first editor, we had a conversation about, she gave the jacket designer the thing saying, no pink, no sparkles. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember a while back, Lena Dunham got herself into some hot water because she said she hated the stuff with women with, did she say strollers? Women with strollers and like Diamante things in them. And there is, I mean, there is a kind of British version of that as well. And it tends to involve a woman with shopping bags and a flicky uppy ponytail. So I was very happy to look like I write about a girl meets boy, because I do, and because I'm very kind of proud of romance and proud of the genre. But I did want to feel that I was perhaps pushing forward in it a little bit. And being something that was that had its own personality. I did not want, the truth be told, here was my watchword. I did not want people who were my friends, who I felt that I was speaking to, because you probably have that as well. But when I write, I kind of speak to who I imagine amorphously in my own head to be my own people. And I didn't want them to be put off. But, you know, I don't have a huge kind of sort of I am not romance. I sit in women's fiction kind of idea about myself at all. You know, I'm very happy to be where I am, as long as I look like myself, if that makes sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense. And the three books of yours that I have read all have satisfactory romantic conclusions, which is how most readers of romance, if they were going to put words to it, would say that, you know, that's the fundamental definition of what is allowed to be called a romance. And I believe, although now it's been a little bit of time since I read each of these, but your books are so far always from one main character's perspective. Is that the case?
Yes.
Yes.
It is typically an urban woman in her 30s. So I tick certain boxes from that point of view, and it, you know, and it does focus on relationships. It is a relationships drama of some sort each time. Yeah,
right. And I feel that, let's say one has a goal of writing a romantic plot arc, but you want to maybe accomplish more than just what happens between that couple on the page. There's, I've noticed sort of two distinct ways to make that really a crossover to another kind of novel. And one is to have just the one perspective like that, because then there's literally more room in the book for that person to have more going on. Like, you have a lot of great family relationships, difficult fathers, difficult parents. And the other way is like the Kristen Higgins model, where you have perhaps two women's voices in the book and you don't know which one of them is going to end up with a satisfactory romantic conclusion.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
I think that the distinction that we're making here is that a lot of romances are written dual point of view. The classic romance is he said, she said. You get both sides. You see them both evolving. You know, and both coming together and overcoming whatever it is that stands between them and A, their ability to sustain any kind of romantic relationship, and B, their ability to have a relationship with this specific person. So was there a time when you thought, well, I'm going to put, like, you know, in your latest, did you think about putting his point of view? Or was it always, I write from her point of view and that's where I am?
Do you know what? I've not thought about putting the male point of view in since my second novel, Here's Looking at You, which was a kind of my hapless attempt at a modern spin on Pride and Prejudice. And I really enjoyed having his, I think, do you know what? Some of it was an expression of lack of confidence on my part, that I didn't feel people would read me unless there was a big hook and a big, you know, for want of a less awful word, a gimmick. So I was very much looking for that with my second novel. So you get both perspectives. Do you know what? I've never considered going back to it. I think basically because you tend to think once you've done something once, it's scorched earth. But the only thing I ask myself now is it better in first person or third person? And I think quite often, I always said after my first novel was first person, I always said never again. And I think a lot of novelists are like that. You know, you just think I can't be trapped in one person's head for 100,000 words again. But ever since then, I have found some of the stories just demand it, because you are writing such a personal, intimate perspective. Generally, when it's someone's kind of emotional landscape. So with Just Last Night, I went back to first person because I thought there are things that happen in that book where you have to just hear directly from the person. Like, even creating the small distance of third person would weaken it a little bit.
I don't know about other readers, but while I care a great deal while I am reading, I often don't remember which point of view a book was in. You know, I loved your book and I really enjoyed it. And I was just sitting here thinking, I'm pretty sure that was first person, but I wouldn't, like, you know, I would bet a whole question on it. So,
the case though, I think it's like getting certain plot motors right. The frustration for an author, in a way, is that if you do it right, it's invisible, and if you do it badly, it's visible. So, in a way, it's a high compliment to say I can't remember, because good, yeah. You should have to remember. It's like seeing the ballet dancer sweat, as they say.
No, I remember being deeply immersed in the story, and I remember it with great joy and positivity. But I do not specifically, I couldn't tell you which point of view it was in.
Well, I'm glad to hear both of your perspectives on this, because I thought I was just forgetful.
No.
No, I don't think it matters. You know, you sink in. I mean, sometimes like when a book is written, when you get one of those, the book that's told from like a whole bunch of different perspectives, I would certainly remember if it was all in first person, because it would, I even sometimes find romances where both the protagonists are first. Like, I just read one that I enjoyed a lot, but there was one chapter, like, at the end when they had really started to come together and were kind of seeing things in the same way, and I was not 100% sure for the first couple pages whose head I was in. I'm not going to say whose book it is, because it sounds like a critique. It was a wonderful book. It just, for whatever, like, for just like a page, I was like, I don't know where I am.
I'm the author about that. I think that if you're intending to create confusion for artistic purpose, it's good. But I think confusion to no purpose is bad.
Oh, I'm sure the author didn't intend it.
Sure, I confused people.
Well, and I am a very fast reader. So there were probably huge tells all over the place that, because I was like, I'm at the end of this book and I must see what happens, I didn't spot. So I'm just, it's just a, you know, I remember when you've got multiple first person point of views, but if I'm just immersed in the story, I'm probably not going to remember which way it was.
A strong agree. Yeah.
We don't, as a matter of course, ask every novelist this question, but I feel like with your books, I'm specifically curious to know whether you consider yourself a plotter or a seat of the pants kind of writer.
Well, my answer to this is I am 50-50. I could not be a plotter fully, and I could not be a pantser fully. I think with the plot, I need to know when I set out, I feel like I'm a tour guide in this world for you. And I feel that if I didn't know where we were going, that we could meander meaninglessly. And I like to feel that when we set out on the journey, I'm telling you things for a reason and I'm pointing things out for a reason. So that, for me, I know it's very personal to every writer and there's no right or wrong. For me, I need to know where we're going, because that will influence what I show you on the way, what I want you to see and perhaps what I don't want you to see. As for full pantsing, I couldn't do that, because I think that brutally, when you write to a schedule and you're being paid to do it, I think that the chances of ending up in a complete message are so high. Like, the chances of getting 40,000 words in and going, oh no, hang on, wait, that isn't actually what I now realize I should have started over here. Like, that is just a no-go.
So how do you pull that together from the beginning? You know, when you're at that moment when you're like, okay, time to do the next one, what kind of things come first?
I've never been asked what comes first before. That's very interesting. I think who she is would be my number one question. Who is this woman? And then the next thing is, what are her challenges? What are her dilemmas? What adventure is she going to go on? What ringer am I going to put her through? And what's she going to find out about herself during? But the analogy I always use in terms of what I know about the plot when I set out is, it's like a train journey. I buy a ticket with a destination in mind. I maybe know the big stops along the way, but I don't know the smaller stops and I don't know the scenery. Because I think the problem with being 100% plotter is, first of all, I think it's quite boring for you as an author, because I think you need to leave yourself some surprises and some wriggle room. And the other problem is, I personally don't have all my good ideas up front. I sometimes can get into a novel and think, oh God, wouldn't it be amazing if this happened? And I think you have to be able to respond to that. And I think there is a sort of organic development of the story that you've got to be, this is going to sound really lovely now, but like, you've got to be open to the story developing. And I think if you've gone chapter 13, no, this happens, I'm going to treat it like a shopping list, then I don't think it's as alive as it could be. But yes, I've always known, I've never been surprised. You know, there's when writers say, characters started talking to me and I had no idea if they were going to end up together. And then at the end, and it's like, no, I've always known where I'm going, which I hope doesn't translate to feeling thuddingly obvious to the reader.
Well, when you pick up a happy romance, you know, the magic is how they get there, not where they're going.
Exactly. And there's a very brilliant writer in Britain, a guy who's adapted a lot of Jane Austen, a guy called Andrew Davies, and he says that whenever he rereads Pride and Prejudice, he still feels peril, like, how will these two people ever get together?
I totally do. I'm absolutely that, like, yeah, that. I also still wish that Lydia would just not do that. I still get really anxious, like, just don't, no, Lydia, don't, no.
It's the argument about letting her to go to Brighton, isn't it?
You idiot. Yes, don't let her go.
Let it go. And I think it's a bit of a mistake to think that there is, you know, there can't be peril in a genre, as you say, where you know how it's going to turn out. The pleasure is, I'm going to do this and we know where we're going to end up, but you can't see how I'm going to get you there.
Some of us like to know where we're going to end up, even in other... I have been known to look at the end of a thriller to know whether or not somebody is going to be alive or not, because it's really hard for me it's hard for me to enjoy the book. And like I said, I'm a really fast reader, so if all I'm trying to figure out is whether somebody's going to die, I'm going to miss a lot. So if I just go figure that out, then I can really enjoy the journey. I know, it's aggravating.
Shocking. I think that's got to be a personality type.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People who look at the last page, I couldn't do that.
I very much hope that readers of Vari McFarlane's new novel do not do that.
Oh, agree. That was one where it was an absolute pleasure to have been surprised. And now we will struggle. It must be hard to market it in part because of that too.
I think so. I think I have to say, I mean, obviously I know all authors have to be nice about their publishers, but I will say, I think HarperCollins have been really deft in the balance they've struck, because I think it's intriguing. And a lot of readers have said, I didn't get what I expected, but I'm pleased with what I got, which I think is a very hard trick for a publisher to pull off, actually, because I think how close is a mislead to a disappointment?
Right. Well, that's what I said on Instagram. That's what one of my friends said on Instagram. You know, not that many of us have read it yet because it's still in advanced copies. It comes out in May, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
So as you listeners are hearing this, it will be either immediately available or, you know, almost immediately available.
I have a question about the title. I looked at your bio on the HarperCollins website, and it has a book Just Last Night, like the copy that I have. And there's a cover that says Last Night. Is that the British cover or?
There's a very simple answer for that.
Okay.
Came up with the title last night in the UK. We were all very excited and we thought, oh, it fits perfectly. And then when I spoke to William Morrow, they were like, it's a little bit of a taken title in the US. It just basically didn't come up if you search for it fast enough. I mean, it's brutal, isn't it? We've got to talk about algorithms, but it is the reality of modern publishing. So they couldn't call it Last Night and it not get kind of lost in the mix. And we played around with different things. But of course, About Last Night is such a famous film. And it's the first thing you think about. So Just Last Night was the compromise of, let's keep it seeming, you know, keep that link with the UK title, but not change it too much. So, yeah.
Was it their idea or yours to try? Because you could conceivably market this book as, this is a book about this thing that is the spoiler that we are not going to talk about. I mean, it could just as easily have gone that way. What was that decision like?
It wasn't, do you know, it's a funny thing. It's not something that I'm particularly involved in. You kind of write the book, you hand it over, and then they are allowed to say, right, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. There's another book in my backlist, and actually it's my first William Morrow book in the States as well, Don't You Forget About Me. That has a big hard punch in it. Narratively, less so than Just Last Night. And they decided to keep that quite low in the mix as well. So it's a kind of combination of spoiler concern, but also if it's a romance and you foreground something quite hard, it's quite difficult, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's a chance I would not have picked up Just Last Night.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, especially it would have depended on the moment, yes. Right? But I am so glad that I did. I love this book and highly recommend to absolutely everyone. Don't even think about the fact that there's a punch coming. Roll with it, because it's so good, especially the second half.
I tell you what I like about the rolling with the punch of it is that it means that you roll with the punch, kind of analogous to the protagonist.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not her life and it's not her reality, and then suddenly it is her reality. So you sort of suck in your breath and go on that journey with her, which I think works quite well.
Well, in life, that is how things work. The punches come out of the blue. That is the very definition of it. But it is really, really hard to pull that off in fiction. I haven't seen it work that many times.
Thank you. Wow. Do you know what? I'm glad we're having this conversation on this side of the book. I think beforehand I'd be like, yeah, you're right, I shouldn't do it.
No, read it. It's great. It's great. We love it. We love it this way. So we talked a little about what comes first. As you're sort of thinking up, I'd like to explore your idea creation a little bit more, not totally for any personal reasons that have to do with anything that I'm working on at the moment while my editor has the major draft of my next book. So, it's not about that at all, but I would still like to explore how you get started. So you start with your character, but how do you come up with the, you know, how do you think of the destination that also goes with who she is and what her problems are? What's getting in her way?
So how do I choose the big challenge of the novel?
Yeah, and sort of, do you wander around in the woods thinking out loud, or do you write? You know, what how does this happen for you?
I wish I had a really smooth, snappy answer to this, and if I did, I would probably be better at coming up with the ideas for my book. But the truth of the matter is, I always kind of sound waffly and obfuscatory, and it's simply because I don't really know is the honest answer. And like, if you even go back to any of my novels, I'm like, when did I come up with that idea? And I don't really know. Like, it's jigsaw puzzle pieces, isn't it? And then at a certain point, like, I'm working on my new one at the moment, and I said to my editor the other day, what I have here is loads of really great ingredients, but not a recipe. And I think that's it. It's like also the alchemy of when does X, Y, and Z suddenly turn into, oh, I've got a recipe, I've got a story here. And I don't know. I don't, it's such a crap answer, isn't it? But I don't know. I remember with my first novel, You Had Me at Hello, is about, it's set in two time frames. It's set in back in someone's college years and present tense when they meet again 10 years later. And that came from the fact that I had the best time at what we call university. And I was thinking about how poignant, like, I would look back on my university pictures and be like, what a bubble of time, you know, that was, and what a great time we all had. And I had a moment of thinking, wow, imagine if you fell madly in love for the first time and you were star-crossed lovers and it went wrong, and then you went on your own way. Like, imagine the intensity combined with the intensity of college, how strong you would feel about that person. And it sprung from there. So I think I do a lot of kind of what if I go on walks and I think, what if this, but what if that? I don't want to get into spoiling other plots, but Don't You Forget About Me is perhaps a version of that. What if, you know, peer pressure at school is such an awful thing, and imagine the things that could happen when you want to fit in. And then you think about the fact romantic comedies involve obstacles and misunderstandings. And then I was like, imagine if that was part of an obstacle and misunderstanding between a couple. So I think it's the what if game. And I like to say, I think that authors share things in common with habitual tall storytellers, that, you know, the person in the office that's always got a story that they're like, the bath fell into the ceiling, and the bath fell into the front room. And you're like, really? It literally fell into the front room? They're like, yeah. And it's only perhaps years later, you're like, that didn't happen. The ceiling cracked a bit at the most. And I think that fiction writers, that's what we do. It's like we sort of play outcomes, and we take a small thing that perhaps has happened in real life, and then we start playing and embroidering with bigger and bigger outcomes or consequences. And I think that's very useful for romantic comedy, because I think with romantic comedy, you're always looking for that sweet spot between escapism and realism. And
right.
I have no good answer for how you find that, because I am struggling at the moment. I'm deep in the plot debate with my editor, and I'm like, would that really happen though? I'm not sure I believe that would happen. Because you like that. I do think that is the hidden big challenge of the genre. Like, people want, you know, obviously, like something like Bridgerton is set in a completely, you know, Regency world, a different world. But when you're setting it in a contemporary setting, the people want to feel that they buy into that world. I know I do.
Right. You want escapism, but not too much escape, you know.
Exactly. Yes. And I have a theory. I think this is what went wrong with the movies, rom-com movies. I think that when Harry Met Sally, obviously, it takes place in a real New York, you believe. It takes place between two people, you believe. And then you sort of scroll forward to, I did actually love this movie, but Justin Timberlake doing flash mob dancing in Grand Central Station. And it's like, as much as I would love that to happen in real life, it doesn't. So it's kind of pulling it back to, you know, what feels extraordinary within something that also feels real.
That's interesting that you talk about romantic comedies on the big screen, because they really did have like a peak era and then sort of die. And I one day when I was supposed to be writing my own novel, I was sort of trying to trace the history. Like, are all of my movie references just old, or was there really a change where they're no longer as, you know, wonderful and reliable? I don't know. Did it get harder to make a rom-com?
I think it did, but I couldn't honestly tell you why. It,
right.
They stopped speaking to women, I felt.
Well, that's probably true.
I also feel like they get caught up in exactly what you said, but that's been done. And the truth is, you know, so fine, do it again, but do it better and do it slightly different, but without going so far as to, you know, have flash mobs or whatever. So I think there's a lot of fear of recreating the wheel. But we like wheels. That's the thing. You know, nobody was ever like, well, I read one book where the couple got together, so I'm done with that now. I need a different book. Like, that's not how readers' minds work.
It isn't true. And it took me years to work this out. You know, I was so paranoid of, but that's been done. But you learn that people love spins on things that have been done.
Yeah. I mean, we love our tropes, right? If you like one book about a mother and daughter separated forever coming back together, you're probably going to like another book about that same thing. That's what we gravitate towards. I was lucky enough to hear somebody talk about that really early in my fiction career. And it helps, although it doesn't stop me from sitting around going, but I can't write another book with two women's voices because my first book had two women's voices. Just like, okay, and what? Yeah? So it's very silly.
I'd like to go back for a second to your question about, would that really happen? Would the bathtub fall through the ceiling? And what I think one of the reasons I like your book so much is that the rules of the world really do hold up. Like, all the people are super realistic. Like, I believe everybody, even the little dog, you know?
Oh.
But I guess I'm also always struggling with the same thing. Like, you have that first idea of like, oh, maybe the ceiling is a little bit wobbly. And I usually find in my own work that I actually have to go back and make the bathtub fall through the darn ceiling. Because I'm, as a very practical person who lives in a very real world, I'm usually afraid to do that. And so it's exciting to me to see you make this really real world work on some conceits that are actually pretty tricky, like the underlying conceit of don't you forget about me, that they had this deep love affair as teenagers and then he forgets who she is. It's so cool. And, you know, also hard to pull off. And did you, you know, how did you decide to really just go for that one?
Do you know what? I think you hit on a good point there. I think there were some debates between myself and my editor about, come on, is this really realistic? And I think I try and what's the writing phrase? Hang a lampshade on it when there's actually an internal conversation with my heroine going, well, who knows how many Georginas he's had since? And I think that perhaps that's an example of when we're a few steps ahead of the heroine, because of course he can't possibly, well, we know from the genre and we know from the point of his importance in the story, he can't have forgotten her. However, also our practical brains are saying, come on, even if you've been the stud of Yorkshire for all those years, you're still going to remember a girl you had a fling with at school.
Well, plus it plays on our own insecurities as humans, like, oh, I am so forgettable.
Well, yeah, I think that's why it works, is that it's not so much that you believe he would forget about her as it is that you believe she would believe it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and all of us can relate to that. Like, you know, he's the greatest, of course. I mean, I can relate to that with someone that I had like a multi-year relationship with.
Yeah.
If I ran into him now, I'd be like, oh, hey, remember me? I mean, you know, I totally would.
Yes. And I think I hope that I took the curse off a bit by the fact that we kind of know that he's pretending. We know that he's saying it, you know, in the same way that Darcy says Elizabeth's beneath him and he won't dance with her. He says it once. He says it once, and from that point onwards, it's not true. So yeah. But I did, with my last novel, If I Never Met You, that came from quite directly thinking, how do I make a trope that is so high concept and so ridiculous, which is the let's have a fake relationship. Mm-hmm. Have any of us known in real life two people who were faked?
None, and yet I love that trope.
And yet, so I said to myself, how do I make that believable? How do I actually contrive that two people would bother to do that? Two people who'd want to spend some time with as a reader as well, not ridiculous narcissist fantasists, and had real fun with it. And I think that, that again, that's just the sweet spot of rom-com, isn't it? It's escapism versus realism.
Mm-hmm. And we love it. I've started to try to think, well, what would I mean, I've always thought, and I'm fairly new in my fiction career, like, what's the stupidest thing this person could do at this moment? Because otherwise I have a real tendency to be like, and the sensible thing would be to just go talk to him. And then my book is over. Right? So I what's the stupidest? But now, lately, what I'm trying to think is, what would I really like to see happen? Like, you know, not that I want anybody else's tragedy to, but if, like, somebody leaving a baby on my doorstep, that would be really interesting. That would be a fascinating day, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. It's not so much that I want that, but, like, I love to read about that sort of thing. Or Emma DeLord's latest, the one where the girl discovers a full-blooded sister was put up for adoption before she was born. That was, I mean, you want to talk about something hard to pull off in terms of, like, the believability of it. And she totally
it
does.
It happens.
And she totally does pull it off. But that's like, I would love to go on like a genetic website and find a full-blooded sibling that was also really awesome. That would be so, you know, I mean, I don't know that I would really love it because it would probably be very dramatic and my parents would everything, but it sounds great, right? So anyway, the sort of what would be, you know, what meteor could parachute into life that I would really like to read about is like kind of my new way of thinking about it.
It might be a funny reference at this point, but I always remember David Simon saying about The Wire, it's a travelogue for lives you will never lead. And in a way, that's all fiction, isn't it? It's like, I send my heroines on adventures that I will never have myself.
Yeah.
So I like to take, you know, a set of responses and emotions and a psychological makeup that feels very real to me. And then I like to give them challenges that I hopefully won't have myself. Because in my book, God, I sound like I'm plugging all my novels here. I've never mentioned so many of my books in an interview before.
but we love them and we want people to hear about them.
Thank you. But in Who's That Girl, the heroine is, she does something. She kisses the groom at a wedding and it causes a complete prolapse of her social media. In the way, you know, in the olden days, it would just be a terrible gossip and everyone would shun you in the office and, you know, you'd lose friends. However, now we live in these great temples online of our online reputations, she loses all her social media. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, how do we cope in this very strange narcissistic age where we're all gazing into the budgie mirror of ourselves in social media all the time and managing? We're sort of all mini celebrities, aren't we? Because we all manage what we're prepared to share online. And so I just found that really interesting. I just thought, I wonder what that would be like and what you would do and how you could recover from that. So that's probably a very long way around again to your question about, you know, where do you get your ideas from? I think it's just you know, again, the what if, but the awful, you've got to give your heroines awful what ifs, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No obvious. Yeah. We got to mess with them. That's the rule. So we should take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk about what else we've been reading.
If you like hashtag am writing, and I know you do because you're here listening, you will love Writing Class Radio. Writing Class Radio airs true personal stories and gives you tips on how to write your own stories. We're also open to airing and discussing your personal essay. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Find Writing Class Radio wherever you find your podcasts.
Vari, we always like to ask our guests to go first, so I hope I'm not throwing you on the spot, but we would love to hear what you have been reading and loving lately.
I am currently reading and loving a novel by a British author who's had vast success, so I've got a feeling you might have heard of her, Beth O'Leary, who's written The Flatshare. So I'm just about halfway through The Flatshare at the moment. I'm very, very late to it. It's already a huge hit and she's like on book three, and I'm doing an event with her in May. So I thought, right, I'll gen up on this. There is no other reason that I'm so late other than that I find reading in my genre really hard, because I just think I'm going to hear the voice of the author in my head and I'm going to start copying them and I'm going to lose confidence in what I'm doing. Writers are just, we're just a very insecure, envious band of people, and I just get terrified all the time. And do you know what, to my great shame, I've still not gone back to Sweet Sorrow by David Nichols, which I started reading on a flight to Canada, and I got a few chapters in and he's so brilliant. I'm sure you know David Nichols well in America. One Day.
Of course.
His voice gets into my head and I'm like, oh God. And his way with an analogy is so beautiful. So I'm very cautious about what I read and I'm very slow. So I'm like the most crap guest on that point. I don't have a dazzling array of 5 bestsellers to tell you about.
Well, I really liked Beth O'Leary's second book, The Switch, and I have not gotten back to The Flatshare because I do have it. However, it is in Spanish. And my because I thought that would be like a really smart Spanish education way. It's called El Piso para Dos. And I thought that would really help my, and it's too hard for me. But I haven't brought myself to bring it in English, although I'm sure that I would love it because The Switch is so, so much fun. So, you know, a year from now when my Spanish education has advanced further, perhaps. And it's not even, you know, it's an English book, it's a translation, but yeah. It's really the books in Spain are they're different. It's got like red paint on the edges of the pages.
Oh, spray edges! Yes, beautiful.
Ooh, yeah. Term of art there. How about you, Serena? What have you been reading?
Oh, it's been such a stressful month. I am reading The Price You Pay for College by Ron Lieberman, because that's what we're talking about over here. And as a comfort read, I'm rereading a couple of books by Kristen Ashley, who is a romance novelist who always picks those crazy plot points. In fact, there's a bathtub that falls through the ceiling in one of her books, but also the heroine gets kidnapped in every single book, and it's funny. So... So it's a great exercise for remembering that you can let your heroines have lots of nutty things and still keep it together.
We are always reminding each other that readers, including us, we love melodrama and we love tropes. We just do. I just finished a wonderful romance that I totally recommend to either of you when you get around to needing a lift. It is Abby Jimenez's new book. It is called Life's Too Short, which is kind of a generic feeling title, but man, it fits the book so well. And it is a complete joy and a real ride in terms of... you know, I actually really questioned what the happy ending would be. I mean, it's a romance, so you know a happy ending is coming, but there are a couple ways it could have gone. Anyway, excellent, excellent book. Recommend. All right, well, this has been lovely. Vary McFarland's latest book, as I think we have said a few times, is just last night. It's just out and it's just excellent. Where would be the best place for our listeners to follow you?
Probably Twitter, which I waste far too much time on. So, but with my very strangely spelt name. So my handle is at Vary McF. So that's MHAIRI and then obviously MCF. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. I'm just
referring to social
popping
media.
That into the show notes.
All of my 45 years at this point.
And Serena, you want to take us out?
I sure do. Until next week, everyone. Keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save, pause, stop.
Thank you.